First thing I need to do is apologize for speaking in English. Okay? As you know, the English are notoriously lazy at learning languages. So myself and Robert will be speaking in English, but those of you who cannot understand English, you have headphones. Yes? Everybody? No? Okay, the ones who can't understand, enjoy the pictures. Okay? I'm very honored to have the star of today's show, Robert Bovell, in the front seats, because normally when I speak, he goes to the back and falls asleep, hoping that I won't notice. But he's a very loud snorer. So we have to keep an eye on him. Can you make sure if he goes, you kick him like this, okay? Good. Now, this is a pyramid-free zone for 1 hour. Okay, no pyramids, no cartouches, no huge stone blocks. Okay, this is a very different sort of lecture. Whatever Dominic said to introduce me, it's about the origins of Egyptian civilization. So here we go, Egyptian Genesis. It's all about the how it all began. Where did Egyptian civilization come from? Is it indigenous to the Nile Valley, or is it from outside? That's what we're going to address today. When I wrote a book on this subject back in the 1990s, this is a brief introduction of what the whole process of discovery was. The origins of pharaonic civilization have always been shrouded in mystery. What caused dynastic cultures to birth forth in the Nile Valley within such a relatively short period of time? It has long been recognized that the emergence of pharaonic rule, this is the pharaohs now, not the indigenous people, coincided with an entirely unprecedented series of phenomena which form the recognizable foundation of what we identify as pharaonic Egypt. Okay? So we're dealing with the elites, we're not dealing with the ordinary people. We're dealing with the people in charge of the country. Now, these innovations that occur at the particular period I'm going to show you include decorated lug-handled pottery. I'll show you what a lug-handled pot looks like in a minute. Stone vessels appear for the first time. Zoomorphic vessels. A zoomorphic vessel is something that is represented in the shape of an animal. Okay, so a stone vessel carved in the shape of an animal. A carved slate palette, like the one you see here. This is a typical pre-dynastic slate palette that you see there. This is not going to work on this screen, I don't think, because it's a screen that doesn't work with a laser. So I'm going to have to use one of these. Pear-shaped mace heads. I'll deal with that a little bit later. You'll understand that better a little bit later on. Military standards. So we see for the first time where the followers of Horus are carrying the standards insignia of their different clans. High-prowed boats. This is very important for Dominic. This is a key factor that we see featured in this period. Mud brick architecture. The niched facade, palace facade. I'll explain that a little bit later too. Early writing occurs at this time, right at the beginning, probably about 400 years before the first dynasty. And then kingship. Before this time, we have no kings in Egypt. The kings start in this era. So let's look at the timeline for a moment. The Nakata I period, we call it, is from around 4,400 BC. This is the time that Robert writes about in his book, The Black Genesis. So he is dealing with the Nilotic peoples coming from sub-Saharan Africa into the Nile Valley, developing certain cultural traits, astronomy, the worship of the cow, domestication of animals, that sort of thing. Happens in this period here. Then we have Nakata II, which is a different culture. And in between here, around 3,500 BC, we get our first contact with Mesopotamia at this time. Okay, so indigenous valley peoples, here something new comes in, and we have this contact arriving between the two. And then there's a Nakata III period, which is an advanced culture. This is where we start to see the kings appearing for the first time here. And again, we have a secondary contact with Mesopotamia between Nicada II and Nicada I. So I'll be dealing with both of those periods. If we look at where that is in Egyptian history, Dynasty Zero is Nicada III, so around the time of King Scorpion, and then we go through to the First Dynasty and the Second Dynasty, Nicada III and onwards, into the Pharaonic period. So the time before that is what we call the pre-dynastic. So the whole era before Dynasty I, including Nicada I and Nicada II, is the pre-dynastic period. I should have said to you, are there any other Egyptologists in the room? Professionals, professional Egyptologists. You recognize an Egyptologist because he always wears a tie, okay? Am I the only one in the room with a tie on? Yes. What are you going to say? Okay, stay awake. So, then one of the things that Robert's dealt with a lot is this idea of the Hermetica, the idea of the traditional stories about the bringing of knowledge by Thoth, the god Thoth, to Egypt. And that is really something involved in what we call the Septepi, the first time, or the primeval age of Egyptian history, where the gods are born, where the gods rule, and then we evolve into the dynastic period. And I'm going to start this talk by introducing to you to something you're probably not familiar with. You all, I'm sure, recognize Edfu Temple, a Ptolemaic or Greco-Roman temple. But in this temple is a record of prehistoric times, the Septepi, the first time. And it's about a mysterious group of gods called the Shebtiu. You've probably never even heard of the Shebtiu. It's not really published in most literature. Egyptologists don't really talk about it either. Most of them don't even know about it. And the reason is because the record of the Shebtiu is recorded high up on the outside of the pronaos, so we're outside the temple here, and this wall, the highest part of the pronaos, has a record of the story of the foundation of Egyptian civilization by the Shebtiu. And what does Shebtiu mean? Well, we'll deal with that now. The scene when you get close to it is of the king. He's worshipping the falcon god Horus, who is standing on the reeds, a bunch of reeds. And on this sacred primeval island, there are eight gods sitting on their thrones, and these are the Shebtiu. Okay, now this is in Greco-Roman times, so it's looking back a long, long way back. But these names are not the names of the gods that you're familiar with. If we look at the first three, the first one is called Wa. Now, Wa means the distant one. And the name Horus also means the distant one. This is also the same epithet that's used for the Mesopotamian flood hero. The three different flood heroes have this same terminology, the distant one. The next god is Aa, and that word means the great one. So we're guessing now who these people are, these two gods are in the pantheon familiar with. And the most interesting one of all is the third one, because his name is Nai. And Nai means the sailor. So Dominic, the third most important god in prehistory is a sailor or a navigator. Now, they have epithets or characteristics. They're called the August Shebtiu, and Shebtiu translates vaguely as the senior ones, okay? They're called the children of Tarchenen, and Tarchenen is the risen land, the primeval mound which rises out of the abyss at creation. If you know your story of Genesis, the world begins with an abyss, okay, and the land comes out of the abyss. They're called the offspring of the creator, and the creator god in Egyptian theology is Atum. They're called the glorious spirits of the early primeval age, or Septepi. And they are also referred to as the builder gods, because they are the gods who build the primeval temple on the primeval mound. They are the designers, the architects of the first temple. They're called the brethren of the sages. And when we count the sages, there are seven in all, altogether. And Thoth, in this temple, is called the leader of the seven. So here we have a situation where we have eight Shebtiu gods, and we have seven sages and one leader. That also adds up to eight. Now, have you ever asked yourself why it is that the pharaohs living in this hot climate have these huge, massive beards? Isn't that weird? Egyptians don't naturally grow big, thick beards, and yet always the pharaohs are shown with these false beards attached to their chins. Why is that? Where does that come from? They also have these boats, these funerary boats, which in this case is buried next to the Khufu pyramid. I swore I would not say pyramid, but I just have. And they are funerary boats designed to take the spirit of the god king to his rebirth. They are taxis that take you for your rebirth if you're a king. In the tombs, you see the same reed boats with their bunches of reeds tied together with rope, with the same shape, with the high prow and the incurved stern, taking the god, the king, to his rebirth on the eastern horizon. Another very strange feature is when you go to the tombs in Egypt. How many of you have been to Egypt? Only a few. That's interesting. When you go into the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, you will see that the god Atum, the ram-headed god, representing the king in this case, is in a cabin inside a boat with a high prow and incurved stern, being dragged by the gods on dry land. No water. Why is that? So, what we have to do is we have to start thinking about not the west, where the bodies of the kings are buried, where the deceased are buried, but the east, because east is where rebirth takes place. East is where the sun rises every morning and is reborn. So the objective of the king, as his spirit when he dies, is to be buried in the west, to travel through the underworld, and to rise in the east with the sun. So creation, rebirth, is not in the west, it's in the east, where the sun rises. So, we're looking for resurrection in the east, and that's where we're going to go now. We're going to go eventually to a place called the Isle of Flame. The Isle of Flame, logically, of course, is an island where you see the dawn light rising beyond the mountains, giving the idea of a flame or the light appearing. In a place the Egyptians call Lightland. So, Lightland is where the dawn is to the east. So we're going to find answers to this question, or these questions, to the east of the Nile in what we call the Eastern Desert. And that's where we're going to go now. The area we're talking about is between, in the north, Abydos, or Thinis, down the Nile, past Thebes, past Nekhen, one of the kingdoms, two of the main pre-dynastic kingdoms are Nubt and Nekhen, past Edfu, down to Komombo and to Aswan. So this zone here, between Abydos and Aswan on the eastern side, of the and this of course is the Red Sea here, this is the area we're going to look at now. You would think there was nothing in there, wouldn't you? Just desert. But actually in that area there is where Egypt began. There are two main wadi routes. The first one from the Red Sea comes out at Nubt here through the Wadi Hammamat. Nubt in Egyptian means gold town, so it's like the Klondike, okay? Nubt means gold town. And the second one is a Wadi Barameer, which leads to Nekhen, and also this is a gold mining area, so both here and here are the two main gold mine areas in ancient Egypt. Poor old Barry's going to be exhausted by the time we finish this. So if we look at a simplified map, you have the main transverse Wadi from Nubt and Gebtu all the way to the Red Sea, and you have Nekhen and Nekheb on either side of the river going all the way to the Red Sea, the two main transverse routes. And of course they represent the two earliest kingdoms in Egypt, the kingdom of Seth and the kingdom of Horus. The capital of the Horus kingdom is Nekhen, the capital of the Seth kingdom is Nubt. And when these two kingdoms are reunified, the new kingdom has its capital at Chenu, which is Abydos today. Greek name Abydos. Now don't get too excited because Arthur Weigel is not a German. He has a German name, but he's actually an English explorer. He was inspector of antiquities at Luxor in the early 1900s, and in 1907 he went into the Eastern Desert. We're just going to follow his journey a little bit. He wrote about it in this book called Travels in the Upper Egyptian Deserts, and in there he illustrates some of the things that he found in the desert area. Now, I went out in this area in the 1990s with a team of people to survey the entire region to look for rock art and prehistoric signs of civilization. So here we are looking at an angle now, the kingdom of Nut and then Luxor, right down to Edfu, and then the wadis which lead to the Red Sea over there. Now, what Arthur Weigel did was he got married to an American called Hortense in Luxor, and for his honeymoon, he took her into the desert. Not very nice of him. They camped in the desert for a week, and they were looking for various bits of evidence together. So I'm going to take you on that route. He went down by train down to Edfu, and he collected a couple of camels from there. His camel was called Gertrude, and they then hiked with their camels for 2 days to this place in the Wadi Baramiya called Canais. Now, Canais is an extraordinary place because in Canais is an amazing temple. So the area that we went to survey was from Canais going northwards all the way up to Nubd. This whole area was surveyed over a period of about 8 years with a fleet of vehicles looking for rock art. Now, you can see here the temple of Canais. It's what we call a Speos temple. It's cut into the rock, and then the outer part is built out like this. It's dated to the time of King Seti I, who is the father of Ramesses II. Okay, so it's New Kingdom. But it was built there as a commemorative monument for the preservation of the gold mining workers, the army which came into the Eastern Desert to cut the gold out of the mountain, and they built this temple to the gods to celebrate that action. But they weren't the first people to arrive there. Here's the temple, and behind it is this massive cliff face here. And what we found was, or what Weigel found was, that when he came here to camp here, he was looking on this surface here and he found hundreds of carvings, rock carvings, prehistoric rock carvings. Here we are looking at those very, very badly worn inscriptions. You can hardly make them out from this shot, but I'll give you a couple of examples of them. These are the types of things that Weigel found and copied into his book. The predominant thing you see there are boats. Lots and lots of boats. We call this one here the golf club boat because it has a golf bag with four clubs in it. You'll notice that they all have a typical thing about them. They have the high prow and the incurved stern. They usually have a central cabin. They quite often have a figure of a person with raised arms on them. And some of them have oars represented by these strokes and possibly figures represented by the strokes above. And notice again you have these figures with the arms raised above the heads. You also see, incidentally, elephants, gazelle, ostriches, because in this time, which is called the subpluvial or the pre-dynastic Neolithic wet phase, this area was savanna, and there were lots of animals and trees in the region. So here we are recording one of the boats that Weigel found, and I'm going to show it you in detail to give you an idea of the sort of thing it is. Now, quite often when you get it in this condition, you see the patina is a little bit lighter than the rock surface. That's the sun tanning effect. So when this was carved in 3400 BC, around that time, it was white, and over the centuries it's become darker, almost back to the original colour of the rock. But if I get rid of the background, you see it a little bit better. Now, so we have the high prow, the flat bottom, and then the incurved stern. Sometimes we have an animal on the back, a totem. We have a central cabin, and we have a figure with raised arms above his head or her head, and quite often we have twin plumes on the head as well. Sometimes we have oars, sometimes we have people, and then there's other things on here we can't explain. Dominic, like this, we never know what this is over here. But this is the general pattern of what we see. There are other examples. Look at this one here. This boat here is 1.5 meters in length on the carving, and it has some 46 crew members. It's a big ship. We have fleets of ships. 1, 2, 3, 4. This one has a main figure in the center. All of them have large crews. This one is very interesting because here we have oars with the paddle on them. We have palm fronds on the front, and we have two figures, this one and this one, and they're both pointing in the direction of Egypt. Whenever we see these figures pointing, they never point away from Egypt, they always point towards Egypt. And you see there is a number of crew and they're rowing. It looks to me like they're rowing forward, not backwards. They're not rowing like this, they're rowing like this, pushing the boat, as far as we can tell. And you'll notice on the back, we have a bull standard on the back. Here then is a very large ship, again about 47 crew members altogether. So they're battleships, they are not religious boats, they're not funerary boats, they are full of warriors. You wouldn't have ships that size as a funerary boat. This is the classic boat. This is one of the most important sites in the desert, and you see again the incurved stern, the vertical prow, the cabin, the figure with raised arms and twin plumes on the head, and quite often an animal at the back there. This one is so old and it's been exposed to the sun that the patination of the rock and the patination of the carving are almost identical. The only way you can really see it is because of the cutting back of the rock surface. If I clear the background again, you can now see a high-prowed boat with an incurved stern, a figure with raised arms, twin plumes, a cabin, and here you can see a very good bull with the four legs. So bulls have something to do with it. Figures with raised arms have something to do with it. Figures with plumes on their heads have something to do with this. And there's a central cabin, and they have this typical shape of the type of boat we see in the desert. So there's your bull at the back. If we compare that to the later palettes from the Nakada III period, or Dynasty Zero, here we see the king represented as a bull, smiting his enemies. That's significant, that connects us from this to this. And you see the enemy has been overthrown, and you see the bull goring the enemy. This section here I'm going to make horizontal for you so you can see it better. Here we see the followers of Horus, the standards. This one here is Wawet, the opener of the ways. This is Anubis. This one is Thoth. This one is Horus. And this one is Min, the desert god. But their totems have hands on the end, and they're grasping a rope. Unfortunately, what they're pulling is missing from the stone. But they are dragging something. So the followers of Horus, the Shemsu Hor, who are associated with the arrival of the gods, are dragging something with a rope. So here we're going off in our vehicles, our Toyota Land Cruisers, out into the desert. We spend normally 4 to 5 days at a time, by which time we run out of water, we run out of fuel, and you try eating Egyptian bread after 5 days. You really want to go back to the Nile Valley after that time. So you travel through different types of terrain, but there's a lot of flat wadis and a lot of rock surfaces. The actual elevation from the Nile to the centre of the desert is something like 40 metres, and it drops back to the Red Sea again. So it's not a particularly steep incline. A typical example of the sort of work we do involves a real German, Hans Winkler, who was an explorer from this region. He did all this for the Robert Mondi exhibition in the 1930s, and this is his map here of what he actually discovered. All these places are numbered are rock art sites. You can see this is the Wadi Hammamat here, where he started work. That's number one, number two there, three, four. So these are all the rock art sites he found. And we thought, oh, okay, well, one we want to go to is site 26 down here. Piece of cake. Look at it, it's easy. We just go along the tarmac road and we come down through here. There's nothing there. We can get there very quickly in a day. No problems. It took us 3 expeditions to find that site. And I'll tell you why when you see it a little bit closer. So we go closer. You think, this must be easy. What you've got to realise is that Hans Winkler didn't explore these areas. They're blank on his map because he didn't go there. So it looks falsely simple. It looks like you just have to come down here, past 24B, and arrive at site 26. But let's just look at this little bit of the map on a modern cartographic map from the Egyptian government, and this is what it looks like. You try and find your way through that. There is site 26. and we are coming in over there. This is why it took us three expeditions to find it. So site 26, I'll now take you to. You'll notice the wadi opens up here. There was probably a lake in here originally, which is why the site is so important. So this is a lake bed, and the surface we're going to examine is this one here. It doesn't look that impressive at the beginning, but I want to focus in on this section here, and we have one of the largest rock carvings in the desert. It's about a meter and a half in length, with a boat with a very flat bottom. Let me just take it in a little bit closer for you so you can see it better. And again, I'll remove the background, clean it up. So we have a high prow, high stern, two adult figures and three what appear to be children here. These two adults are carrying bows and they have plumes on their heads. It's almost like a sacred family is coming into Egypt, with perhaps this boy is the oldest, second boy, maybe a little girl down here. You can see another ship up here with another chieftain with a throw stick and the crew as well. Now, all this stuff we found, probably in the region of more than 1,000 boats have been discovered so far, and we've only scratched the surface here. Why do we have so many boats in the desert between the Red Sea and the Nile is a big question. Why aren't these drawings along the Nile? Why don't we see them in the Sahara? We only see them here. We now come to William Matthew Flinders Petrie, who is the father of Egyptian archaeology, and he excavated the site of Naqada, which is the cemetery for the kingdom of Seth in the north, Nubt. And he was the guy who found this remarkable type of pottery and some other very important artifacts. This is Naqada here, Naqada 2 now. So this is the second phase of Naqada. And these are excavations of tombs from the Naqada 2 period, the elite graves there. About the second half of the fourth millennium. What's important, for the very first time now, we see that graves are lined with mud bricks. Prior to this, there are no mud bricks in Egypt. This is the first time we see mud brick architecture, and it's to line the pits of the tombs. In the tombs, this is pre-mummification, we have the bodies of the individuals buried with this remarkable buffware pottery, which appears for the first time at this time. Also in the graves, we find zoomorphic statuary made of beautiful stones from the desert, from the eastern desert. Again, we have these vessels made of stones. These are log handles. So this is log handle stone vessels. And here we have log handled, you see the log handles here, pottery, this buffware. And always the buffware has these boats with oars and cabins, ostriches and mountains. These are the typical decorations we find in the Naqada too, harking back again to the desert. We also see for the very first time in Egypt, and only for a short period, we see cylinder seals. Now, cylinder seals come from Mesopotamia. Okay, so the land of the two rivers, the Euphrates and Tigris, they invented the cylinder seal, but we see them in Egypt now, in the graves of these people. And we also see lapis lazuli in small quantities, but in the elite graves, they have beads made of lapis lazuli. Do you know where lapis lazuli comes from? Barakhshan in Afghanistan. So how does it get to Egypt in the pre-dynastic period? Big question. It then disappears. It's not there in the Old Kingdom. It disappears. One important clue as to when this happens is this guy. We call him Mace Man. He's in a boat. I'll get you a bigger picture of him. He's in a boat, standing there. He has what appears to be a tail on the back. He's got two plumes on his head, and he's carrying a pear-shaped mace. Okay, now what's a pear-shaped mace? Well, I'll show you. It's what the kings carried. It's the weapon par excellence of the pharaohs. So whenever you see a pharaoh, he's either smiting his enemy with one of these maces, or he's carrying it, in the case of a Middle Kingdom pharaoh here. So this pear-shaped mace is very important to kingship. It's one of the motifs of kingship in Egyptian history. Here is the difference between the two maces. This is the Naqada 1 mace. It's what we call a disc-shaped mace. So it's a thin object like this, and if you hit somebody on the arm, you might bruise them. You might be lucky to break their arm. You hit someone on the head with that, and they're dead. This little bit of technology between this and this is the difference between the original people and the ones who conquered the original people. One little bit of technology. A more heavyweight mace, which when you strike somebody with it, you kill them, you don't wound them. And here you see a typical early dynastic. This is King Den. And you see that he's got a pear-shaped mace and he's smiting his enemies on the head. A motif you see throughout Egyptian history. Ritual slaughter with a mace. Now, you might ask again, like the lapis lazuli, like all the other objects, the pear-shaped mace begins life in Mesopotamia. We see it for the first time in the Uruk period, Uruk IV period. So it's an import from Mesopotamia into Egypt. Here you see a Mesopotamian king, please note the big beard, and in his hand, he's carrying a mace. I'll just highlight it. There's his mace, and he's smiting the enemies with his mace, just like the Egyptians. But this is a king from Mesopotamia. This is not an Egyptian king. When we look at the Nama palette, you see Nama with his bull's tail, carrying his pear-shaped mace, wearing the red crown, and this is his name here, Namer. And here behind him, but look at this, is a very interesting little object. Oh, there's the mace, sorry, in close-up. There's the bull's tail. And we have this servant here, what we call a sandal-bearer. He's carrying the sandals of the king, and this is his title. Just like Namer's name is in front of his face, this guy's title is in front of his face, and this rosette here means God King in Egyptian at this time, and this is the hem symbol, which is the word for servant. So it means servant of the God King. So this is the sandal-bearer of the ruler, Nama. Remember that rosette. Hem Necha, or servant of the God King. Here we see King Scorpion wearing the white crown with his hoe cutting a canal, and in front of him you see again his name, the God King Necha, and here we see the word scorpion, so King Scorpion. I'm sure you've all seen the movie. So at this time, we begin to see, at the beginning of Dynasty Zero now, we see the pear-shaped mace appearing. We see the bull's tail on the back of the king, representing the bull. We see the rosette, which marks him out as a god king. And we see the high-prowed boats associated with these people in the desert. So now we turn to religious motifs. Of course, religion has to come into this. First of all, let's look at this rosette in more detail. Here we see a Mesopotamian vessel of Gilgamesh. You've all heard of Gilgamesh. Controlling two lions, wearing a fishnet and holding onto two serpents. But what do we have here? We have the rosette. So this name, this word, is originally Mesopotamian. It's not Egyptian. Another motif we see reflecting later on in history with the tombs is this concept of a ship being dragged by its crew. So here we have a small boat. You can just about make out the cabin here and the goddess figure with the raised arms and the plumes on the head. But here the crew are dragging the ship across the desert. We see lots of these types of drawings in the desert. Here's another very big example of it, where we have the big boat with lots of people in, and we have the rope, and we have the crew dragging the boat, and we have a smaller team at the back. This is very interesting. When you're dragging a boat around a corner, you don't just pull it from the front that way, but your back crew pull it this way to swivel the boat around rocks. So if you want to navigate through the wadis, you have to have a pulling crew at the front and a pulling crew at the back. These are typical examples of the type of boats we see. There are many different ones here. Some of them have bulls or cows in the boats, represented in the boats, but you can see the general idea of the dragging. That one, remember for later. Oh, in fact, we'll do it now. If you've ever been to Deir al-Bakri, the temple of Hatshepsut, there is a chapel on the left side, which is called the Chapel of Births. And it's there that Hathor, the cow goddess, is giving birth and suckling the pharaoh, who is Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh. Now, it's very hard to see this wall, so again, I'm going to clear away the background and so you can see what's going on. Now it becomes clearer. Here is a high-prowed boat made of reeds because it's bundled together at the top, and you have the goddess Hathor standing in the boat with Hatshepsut in front, but most important of all is we have a wooden sledge under the boat, painted brown, and a rope connected over here where the priests in the rest of the scene are pulling the boat along through the desert, not in the water. Most of these scenes do not involve water. And when a king or a noble is taken to his tomb, he is in a central cabin, his body is lying inside the cabin in a high-prowed boat with an incurved stern, and of course it's on a sledge. See the wooden sledge? And there's the rope, so the nobles are pulling along the boat into the Valley of the Kings. They don't use wheels, they don't use chariots, they don't use carts. They drag the deceased to his tomb in the west in a boat, but on dry land. Now, I had a big debate with Dominic 2 days ago, because he said these big reed boats that he has are too heavy to drag through the desert. And I said, no, I don't agree with you. So I put this in last night for you. This is El Bersha. And this is a famous scene of this huge colossus being dragged by the people through the desert into the Nile Valley. Another example I pulled off the internet is Mons Claudianus, this massive Roman column carved in the quarry 300 kilometers from the Nile, and they intended to drag that to the Nile. So if they can drag that, they can drag a boat. Foreign contact then. This is what we're leading to now. This is not all indigenous. As Robert pointed out very rightly, there is an indigenous population which we could call African, which comes from sub-Sahara and populates the Nile Valley when the land begins to desiccate and the Sahara starts to dry up. They move into the Nile Valley. They're cattle herders. They worship Hathor. They are very important to astronomy. They're very important to religion. But there's this second element which comes in later, and the two marry together to create pharaonic civilization. It's the combination of those two cultures which make pharaonic civilization. The one without the other, we would not have had pharaonic civilization. So let's deal with these foreigners. In the Nama palette, we see this famous sort of antithetical panthers with long necks. And of course, this is in fact a Mesopotamian motif, because here's a cylinder seal from Mesopotamia with exactly the same motif on it. So this is clearly of Mesopotamian origin. On the Jebel El Arak knife, this very famous flint knife with the ivory handle, if I go in a little bit detail with some line drawings, you'll see it better. We have two sides of the knife handle. On this side over here, we have what we call the master of animals motif, which is where you have, like the Gilgamesh one, you have this person controlling two big lions, and you'll notice that the clothes he's wearing are not Egyptian. He's wearing a chignon band, he's got a heavy coat on, he has a big beard. And on the other side, over here, we have a battle. And in the battle, the prisoners are being led away by short-haired people carrying pear-shaped maces. The long-haired people are being taken away or murdered or whatever they're going to be happening to them. And all the way through this, it's the short-haired people who are winning the battle and the long-haired ones who are losing. The short-haired people have these high-prowed ships with a high-prow. They have a central cabin and this strange totem here. The losers, the people with the long hair, have the crescent-shaped ships here and they're drowning in the Nile. This is the first depiction of a battle in history. We don't have one before this. It looks like whoever he is was the leader of these people who defeated these people with their high-prowed ships. So those are foreign vessels, and those are Nilotic crescent-shaped vessels. Here is a typical Mesopotamian sculpture of, again, Gilgamesh holding the two lions by their tails. This is a master of animals symbol. It's clearly Mesopotamian in origin. And we see this same figure that we see on the Nakada knife. We see him here. And he's actually serving the sheep of the shrine of Inanna from Uruk at the same time. And here we see him on a boat carrying the portable shrine of Inanna. And you'll notice the shape of this boat is very important to remember. If we compare it now with the one from Nakada, from the knife to this one, you'll see the same idea, same shape. This back struts here, the loop on the back, and this strange thing here, which on the number one seems to have a rock in it, something to do with weighting the front of the prow. And you see it in the Mesopotamian ship, and you see it in the Nakada ship. So the master of animals motif is from Uruk, from Mesopotamia. The long, heavy gown is typical of Mesopotamian kingship. The full beard that we see in the pharaohs starts in Mesopotamia. We have the chignon headband around the head. We have the hunt, he's a hunter, and he's called the mighty hunter, or the hunter, we call him the hunter king. And he actually sails around in a high prowed boat. So all these elements are Mesopotamian. Now you think this, the white crown of Upper Egypt of the south, is typically Egyptian. Everybody thinks of this as an Egyptian crown, but let's look at the origins of that crown. Well, here we see a cylinder seal impression of the pharaoh with his white crown on. Notice at the back you have the hem netcher that we saw on the Nama palette. Probably his queen being carried along with a palanquin. It's a very simple image, but it's not Egyptian. It actually comes from Susiana, and Susiana is the Iranian part of Mesopotamia, near Ahwaz. So this is an Egyptian pharaoh on a cylinder seal from Mesopotamia, wearing the white crown. And here is a typical god. This is Enki, the god Enki, with the big beard, wearing his crown with the horns wrapped around it. Let's take the horns away and see what we're left with. We're left with the white crown of Upper Egypt. So even the gods of Mesopotamia have the white crown from Upper Egypt as their main crown. In Buto, in the northern delta, northwest delta, recently they found these strange cones which were once decorating a wall in the city of Buto. And in these holes here, they used to put coloured pigments like this. Now this is very unusual. We've never found this in Egypt anywhere else, and it belongs to the pre-dynastic period. They are scattered all over the site. This is not the sort of thing you would invent independently. And when you realize that this material that we see here, decorating the walls, actually is also the way the shrine of Inanna was decorated in Uruk, you see an import into Egypt of something very specific. It cannot be invented separately. Sorry, I've lost this one. How do I do this? That's it. Whoops, that wasn't supposed to happen. So yet you have this particular type of decoration originating in Uruk and then appearing in Egypt suddenly in the delta. No, I went backwards, didn't I? Oh, sorry. I think we'll have to go forward a little bit. Sorry about that. When you're wearing 15 microphones, it's very difficult to control everything. Are you all following things? It's very hot in here, isn't it? Don't worry, Robert, you're nearly on. And I notice you haven't fallen asleep yet. It's really good. Thank you.
I'm asleep with my eyes open.
Oh, okay. Now, here we see another feature. This is Saqqara. These are the first dynasty mastabas at Saqqara, made of mud brick. And we're now introducing ourselves to niched facade architecture. Here is a typical facade of one of these mastabas, plastered with these niches that we see here. It's a very, very important early symbol of kingship in Egypt. Here is an earlier photograph with the decoration painted on the plaster. So it says very much first dynasty. We also see it at Abydos in the Shunat el-Zabib, the great funerary temples where we see this niched facade running along the outside of the mud brick structure. It finishes in the Third Dynasty with the best example of it. This is the Djoser or Djoser step pyramid complex, where we see it refined in stone now, and after this it disappears. In the Fourth Dynasty there are no more niched facades. Where does that come from? Well, I'm sorry about this, it's a dark picture, but this is the Uruk IV temple, about the same time as Nakada II in Egypt, and all the way around this is a niched facade. So the design comes earlier in Mesopotamia. Here is the niched facades on the Uruk temple. You see it close up here. So it's invented in Mesopotamia and is introduced into Egypt just at the beginning of the First Dynasty. Even the brick sizes are the same in both. And it becomes the motif for writing the early name of the king, what we call the Horus name or the Serek name, which is where the Horus falcon is standing on a niched facade palace, and then the name of the king is spelt out in simple hieroglyphs above. So this is in fact King Djer here, or King Zer. But you always see this Serek feature, the Horus facade of the palace, on these early monuments. And even in the Old Kingdom, although there's no more decoration on the outside of the mastabas, we see it on the sarcophagi, on the stone boxes, we see the niched facade. So they bring it from the outside of the mastaba onto the actual box that the body is buried in. Now, are you talking about the Sphinx?
No.
He's not talking about the Sphinx, so I won't talk about the Sphinx either in that case. I just wanted to point out to finish now, because I had to bring a pyramid in somewhere. There are elements, as Robert agrees and I agree and I'm sure Dominic agrees, there are elements on the Giza Plateau which are not Fourth Dynasty, which are earlier than the Fourth Dynasty. We all know about the famous Robert Schoch and other geologists talking about the erosion pattern on the Sphinx and the enclosure. I don't want to talk about that. Other people can do that. What I want to talk about is various other elements here. I don't know if you ever noticed, but when you're coming down this road here towards the Sphinx, there is a quarry here. It's mostly filled with sand, but there's a quarry running around here, and there's a quarry on this side over here. Now, we know from inscriptions that are found in the quarry that the blocks that were taken from here are used for this pyramid, the Khufu pyramid. Okay? But why did they leave this in the middle? Why did they carve the blocks out of here and out of here? They didn't know that was going to get built there. This causeway is earlier than that and that. That causeway leads from this valley temple and the Sphinx temple. When you look at these two monuments, inside the granite there is limestone blocks, big limestone blocks, very heavily eroded, just like the enclosure of the Sphinx. There seems to be a complex here. A Sphinx, a temple here of Mesopotamian design, open central court, another temple next door, which was then later lined with granite on the outside, a ceremonial way which went from the east to the west, and at the top here we have another Neolithic mortuary temple. There are two temples here. There's the mortuary temple of the king next to the pyramid, and then you have a much earlier one here, as though it was something to do with a Neolithic ritual between sunrise and sunset. Robert is the man to tell you all about that, because he's the astronomer. All I'm saying is, when I see this material, I see a complex here before these great pyramids were built. But I want to just pay attention to one thing. Nobody ever goes here, but you see these massive mastabas here. They are rock cut. They are not built. They are not mud brick. If you go to Giza again, go and have a look at these, because there's something very special about them. They are rock cut with niched facades. So they are pre-Fourth Dynasty. Okay? And look at this here. This is Fourth Dynasty. This is earlier. This rock cut mastaba here was then later faced in Fourth Dynasty stonework. If I show you it from a different angle, here you can see the Fourth Dynasty blocks in front of the older eroded blocks of niched facade. Look at the patination difference. This patination has been done by the sun. This is blonde because it originally was covered with Old Kingdom monuments, and it does not have the same patination. So there is something going on at Giza which predates, how much earlier, that's debatable, but predates the pyramids or the fourth dynasty at least. Okay, and it seems to fit into the pattern of having niche facades which arrive in Egypt in Dynasty 1. So it looks like at Giza there is a complex of at least Dynasty 1, if not earlier. So let's look east to finish off now. We sum up with the boat which takes the king through the underworld to his resurrection, where the Khepri beetle pushes the god as the sun god up above the horizon in the east in Lightland. The theology is all about resurrection in the Isle of Flame. So where is the Isle of Flame? Well, the boat that takes these god kings, as we know, is a wooden version of a reed ship. You can see the fluting up the top there of the bundle of reeds, and then this is in imitation of the reed ship with the incurved stern. This is designed to copy in wood the original reed ships which made the journey through the underworld. So where is east of Giza? Well, there's Giza. Let's draw east. And we end up at a place called Eridu. Eridu is at the head of the Gulf of Persia, the Persian Gulf. It is the place where ships were first to arrive in Mesopotamia at this site. Eridu is the oldest city in the world. In the Sumerian Kings List, it says, when kingship first descended from heaven, the kingship was in Eridu. So the Sumerians tell us that this is the first city on earth. In Kuwait, we find, recently the Institute of Archaeology have been excavating there, and they find bitumen pieces like these. This is the same piece on three sides. This is the inside, and it has the marks from the reeds where it's been slapped onto the reeds of the boat. I'm finishing, don't worry. And here we have barnacles on the outside of the bitumen. So this has fallen off a ship that's been in the sea. So these are bitumen-coated vessels with barnacles on, made of reeds. And this is from the Ubaid period, which is before the fourth millennium, before the Uruk period. Now, this is what we think the Isle of Flame is, the very famous place where the gods, the Sheptiu gods, built the primeval temple on the primeval mound surrounded by the Abzu, the freshwater swamp. And the Egyptians refer to it as the waters of Nun. So the waters of creation surround the primeval island, and they call it Nun, the Egyptians. This word does not mean anything in Egyptian. It's the primeval temple that the Sheptiu built before they came to Egypt. And this is it. The very first ziggurat temple to be built anywhere in the world is this one at Eridu, surrounded by the Abzu, and they call this place Nun Ki, the mighty place. And this is the Egyptian word for Nun, the primeval waters of Nun. So it's actually a Sumerian word, it means mighty. What we think happened was that the pre-Sumerians come from Eridu, they sail down to the trade with Dilmun and Magana Maluha in their vessels. Remember, this is where the bitumen was found here. And eventually they decide to sail around the Arabian Gulf, past Punt, into the Red Sea, and cross to form the two kingdoms of Upper Egypt, dragging their vessels across the desert at the shortest point between the Red Sea and the Nile, bringing their Mesopotamian vessels with them, dragging them across the sand, relaunching them in the Nile, and then defeating the Nilotic peoples with their crescent-shaped boats to become the first dynasty of pharaohs. So in the Bible, it tells us that Noah's sons left, the sons of Ham, the grandsons of Noah, left Mesopotamia and founded the kingdoms of Cush, the kingdom of Mizraim, which is Egypt, Masri today, the kingdom of Put, which is Buto in the delta, and the kingdom of Canaan, which of course is Byblos and the Phoenicians, who had this very strong relationship between Egypt, because they were great seafarers. If you go to Canaan today and you go in to sit in a class of children, the Lebanese will tell those children that they originally came from Bahrain. That the people of Lebanon, the Phoenicians, originally came from Bahrain and sailed around and then went into the Mediterranean Sea and settled in Byblos and Tyre and Sidon and all those places. And that, my dears, is where I'm finished. Thank you.